Well, hello everyone. I'm continuing my series here on André Siegfried's book, The Character of Peoples, and we're up to chapter 4, which is called English Tenacity. This should be very interesting. I'll just remind you before we go in that I currently have my spring sale on. It's promo code Mandy. You can get the Trivium with 25% off if you use promo code Mandy or Foundations of Shakespeare or any of the other great courses, but let's not waste any further time and I shall begin to read this. Bear in mind, Siegfried, despite his Germanic sounding name, is a Frenchman or was a Frenchman. This book was written in 1952. He says, to understand the English, we must also begin by placing their country geographically. England is an island, said Michelet introducing a course of lectures at the College of Collège de France, and now you know as much about its history as I do. The observation retains its fundamental significance today. Although England is no longer altogether an island, and the thing which strikes us even more than its insularity is its smallness. The United Kingdom, that is England, Scotland, Wales, and Northern Ireland, is only 95,000 square miles. Great Britain alone is 90,000 square miles, or only 42% of the surface area of France, and only 0.2% of the land surface of the globe. But not so fast. Together with the Empire, or rather the Commonwealth, as they prefer to call it nowadays, the area of territory under British influence amounts to more than one quarter of the total surface of the world. It is not from its metropolitan territory proper that England draws her grandeur. That has other bases and other sources. The fact that 45 million people living on this island have exercised a decisive effect on the world and contributed as much, if not more, than anyone else to the development of our Western civilization is the first fact which immediately strikes us and makes us realize the tremendous performance involved in building up a great power on such a narrow territorial basis. But while recognizing the grandeur of the achievement, we at the same time realize its fragility. We divine immediately that the building up of such an empire and its maintenance over several centuries must have required a combination of really exceptional qualities. No subject is more difficult than the psychology of the English people. And no people have ever attracted our attention and our interest to a greater degree. Our interest and our best writers have shown, our greatest and our best writers have shown the keenest interest in the English. Voltaire, Taine, Boutmy, and Abel Hamant, and in our own days, André Marois. At the same time, there is nothing in our temperament or in our history which makes it easy for us to understand these neighbours of ours, such close neighbours and yet so far removed from us. When he says us, of course, he's talking about the French. When I cross the Channel and arrive in London, I always have the same feeling as being on a new planet. But when I have once got used to the English atmosphere again, it is my own country that I no longer understand. I have never succeeded in understanding simultaneously the British and the French points of view. Successively, I think I have done so, but never at one and the same time. I don't know any two peoples who are less understandable to each other than the English and the French. Psychologically speaking, the Channel, which is so narrow that from Dover one can see the coast of France, is as deep and as wide as an ocean. To facilitate our understanding of the factors and circumstances which have gone to form the English people, let us follow the example of Taine and distinguish between heredity, environment, and time. Great Britain is an island, of course, but it is an island which is very close to the European mainland. It is this close proximity which has determined in the ethnic makeup of the English people, because it brought about a succession of racial admixtures. on an original Iberian pre-Celtic basis, a series of invasions imposed successive layers of Celts, Romans, Saxons, and Normans. However, we must not forget that the last of these invasions now lies almost 1,000 years back. Okay, so I was wondering what he was going to do here. When he says English, I think he's referring to all of the people who live in the British Isles, not just the English. I say that as someone born and brought up, and indeed half Welsh myself. So I think he's going to include the Welsh and the Scots in his assessment here. I was wondering about that because I noted it was English. Anyway, the first was the Celtic invasion, which continued more or less from the 4th century BC until the time of Caesar. The invaders were Bretons and Gaels, and they introduced a people, a language, and a civilization. Then came the Roman conquest, which lasted from 55 BC to the year AD 410. This time, however, it was only a limited military occupation, reinforced by a civil administration. To the north, the Gaels in Scotland were never reduced, and no serious attempt was made to reduce them. The south experienced the rule of Rome, and we can safely say that its effects are still appreciable even today. Oh yeah, what have the Romans ever done for us? You remember that sketch? Okay, let's carry on. After that came the Germanic invasions between the 5th and the 11th centuries, and the Celts were pushed back to the west. Saxons and Scandinavians settled on the east coast and drove forward into the interior. These invaders were to become the dominant factor in the ethnic makeup of the English people. Both qualitatively and quantitatively, it was their stamp which impressed itself most strongly on the country, with the result that the Englishman of today is still essentially an Anglo-Saxon. The final invasion was the Norman conquest in 1066, and to some extent this was similar to the Roman conquest, a military occupation followed by the political dominion of a landed aristocracy imposed upon an already existing population. The Normans brought a language with them, French, a political system and a civilization which was, if not Roman, at least Romanized, because these erstwhile Scandinavians, once barbarians, had been molded and modified by a stay of 2 centuries in France. Let us now see what England owes to these successive invasions. 2 of them, those of the Celts and the Anglo-Saxons, were numerically on a big scale, and they introduced new human stock. The 2 others, the Roman and the Norman invasions, were merely military conquests, which primarily introduced new forms of government. It should be noted that these various waves did not overlap or combine. They followed each other in succession, the one imposing itself on the previous one or pushing it out. They never fused. One could compare the situation to geological layers, each of which remains still separately visible, with the result, for example, that even today the Celt is clearly distinguishable from the Anglo-Saxon. The idea the English hold of themselves depends directly on this historical formation, which is still perceptible in the contemporary social structure, because at the beginning there were always victors and vanquished, aristocrats and subordinates. These distinctions have naturally lost their original sharpness, but they are still present when we are dealing with the psychology of the English people. We must always first ask ourselves whether we have to do with the Celts, the Saxons, or the Normans. The Celt is regarded to some extent as eccentric and even a trifle erratic, but he is more brilliant as an individual. Think of men like George Bernard Shaw and Lloyd George, for example. But it is the Saxon, the human backbone of England, who is really the most authentic and the most national of the English. He is John Bull, with a Germanic side to his character, which cannot fail to attract our notice. As far as the Norman is concerned, a one-time Scandinavian with a Roman-French polish, he is undoubtedly the thoroughbred, the more aristocratic and gentlemanly, and it is still something in England to hear to bear a name like Harcourt, Talbot, or Courtney. There was a time when the country was ruled by the Anglo-Saxons and the Normans. More recently, the democratic tide has to some extent altered that in favour of the Celt. Today, it is no longer a question of me being merely brilliant, and therefore it is questionable whether this change has been altogether to the advantage of the country. If we now attempt to continue our inquiry, we arrive at the conclusion that England's destiny has been largely determined by her isolation, itself the result of her geographical insularity. This isolation does not consist, as we have already seen, in the fact that the island has never been invaded successfully, but in the fact that for nine centuries, the North Sea and the English Channel have offered effective protection against any further invasion. In fact, since 1066 and the Battle of Hastings, there has been no further ethnic contact between the English peoples and the continent. Certainly, there were the French Huguenot refugees after the revocation of the Edict of Nantes in the 17th century, and in the 19th century, there were certain insidious penetration of the city by German and Jewish elements, but on the whole, such immigrations were of individuals only, so much so that England today has some difficulty in regarding herself as really European. You can say that again. A second aspect of this process is the ethnic youth of the people. We Frenchmen, whether Latins or Mediterraneans, have more than 2,000 years of history behind us. The Englishman cannot even remotely equal this record, and in consequence, he is nearer nature than we are, which also means he is nearer to primitive barbarism. Well, is this some French bias I see sneaking in here from Siegfried? But anyway, let's carry on. This gives him a certain spontaneity and freshness, which we cannot match. But it also gives him a certain infantility, which we find very difficult to stomach. When I was an interpreter with the British Army during the First World War, I marvelled again and again at the infantile nature of the officers with whom I associated, and in particular with the generals. Whilst I occupied my leisure hours, like most of my French comrades, I filled my hours by reading philosophical or historical works. My British general occupied his with a detective story, whilst I spent my spare time in reading or in conversation, he would spend his by endlessly playing with his dog. When he was not throwing or kicking or knocking balls around with his subordinates. This passion for playing with balls is something particularly British. It is, in fact, a national trait every bit as profound as the love of the German for marching around under the orders of a superior. Turning now to a consideration of the geographic environment, we come at once to the conclusion that in no other country is the influence of the climate so decisive and so obvious as it is in England. It is a climate of the oceanic type, temperate and without violent extremes, not really cold, though it can be very chilly, and above all, it is damp. I mean, I say that it did rain literally for a year straight before we've had this very nice spring as I'm recording this. With a west wind which prevails for three quarters of the year, it rains a great deal, but with bright intervals which the clear winds of the Atlantic often render glorious. In such a climate, which, whilst it is not severe, is nevertheless testing, a constant effort is necessary in order to survive. In England, it takes a real effort to get out of bed, and that is probably why the Englishman usually rises late, why he is inclined to start the day with a solid breakfast. Porridge. The horse starts the day with oats too, eggs and bacon and so on. You know, it's funny, I struggled to get my little one out of bed this morning, and then I gave her a bowl of porridge. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? My father was almost a total abstainer, but when we visited Glasgow together in the middle of July, he demanded a bottle of Burgundy. This can explain English alcoholic habits. I have often stayed in Oxford, and I was astonished at how long it took the sun to rise. What a contrast with the Mediterranean countries. The result is that the English people are not well adapted to their climate, and this explains their special behaviour and reactions to their natural environment. The mediocrities succumb to a certain torpor, and then they go to sleep, whilst the men of energy resist these influences, and their capacities for energy are increased in the very act of resistance. Sport, which is so widespread in England, and which is, incidentally, really purely sport, can be explained in the same fashion. It is not merely a taste for sport which causes the Englishman to indulge in it. It is a source of necessity. It is the price of survival for the English. It is here that Protestantism finds an opportunity to develop one of its essential virtues, energy, conscience, conscious of itself. Such expressions as life is made to be lived, not to be suffered, and man is made to excel himself, express the tenacity of the English to the full, and with all the moral force of the Reformation. The climate alone is not enough to explain England to us. We must also take her position on the map into account. She has always lived a life apart. In the Middle Ages, England was a small, outlying island regarded as the farthermost region of Europe, after which, towards the north and the west, there was nothing. England remained outside the general flow of European life. But from the 15th century onwards, when, as a result of the discovery of the New World, the Atlantic became a link, a bond of union between the continents, England developed into a sort of general broker to the world. From that point onwards, a contradiction arose between England's traditional insularity and the international commercialism, which now became her real destiny. This contradiction is the very expression of English individuality, because although by temperament England has remained the most insular country in the world, her interests, her outside contacts, and her universal links have caused her to live by exchange, that is to say, by international relations. It is a contradiction which is concealed within each Englishman. Very interesting indeed. And I think we all recognise some aspect of this, don't we? When one speaks of the English character, the first question which arises concerns the nature of the English intelligence. Frenchmen seem to hold two contradictory opinions on the point. Some Frenchmen, for example, the Book of Demolines, go into ecstasies about the superiority of the Anglo-Saxons. Throughout my youth, I heard repeated enthusiastic and almost irritating, because it sounded like a reproach, praise of the practical and expeditious British way of doing things, which was contrasted with our old-fashioned and sterile taste for literature. We were compelled, at least at the time, to recognise the success of our fortunate and efficient neighbours, but the methods which were so highly praised assorted so ill with our classic education that a reaction necessarily came about. The fashion was then to claim that the English were not intelligent at all. That there was a particularly stupid saying, I remember, and again, you're going to have to forgive my French because I am the world's worst, as long-time viewers of this channel will know. The saying is, c'est que cela me fait si je suis bête J'ai la chic anglais. I've probably butchered that and I have no idea what it means. If I bother to discuss such impertinence at all, it is only because the English themselves seem to take a curious pleasure in calling themselves stupid. Case in point, I guess. The famous Colonel Bramble made such an assertion, but his interpreter showed that he understood perfectly well by replying to his chief, Quel cotterie. If our friends over the channel are really stupid, as they are so often pleased to assert, then their stupidity is of a very special kind, because there is certainly no modesty in their admission of it. Sir Charles Dilke, one of our most intelligent and brilliant Englishmen I have ever known, was once asked by an interviewer, "And what, sir, is your general idea?" He got no further because Dilke interrupted him and declared sententiously and a trifle ironically, "Sir, I am an Englishman, and as such, I have no general ideas." Okay, it makes sense. Surely a man must have a great deal of intelligence indeed to boast that he has no general ideas. The truth is that the British intelligence is of a special kind. The English scorn our type of intelligence, which is based on logic. They like to pretend that they are illogical, that they do not take kindly to our Cartesian intelligence, which analyzes, discriminates, and reconstructs, and is aggressively reasonable. Fundamentally, they do not believe that problems are susceptible of a satisfying geometric solution. The Frenchman, with his small rentier psychology, always wants to find a solution for every problem. When he is satisfied that he has done so, he rests on his laurels. Our British friends are wiser. They know that nature does not lend itself to such pretensions. According to them, the only solutions it is possible to arrive at remain temporary, are always precarious ones, requiring constant adjustment. In the old days of sails were set and the position of the course of a ship were charted according to the winds and the tide, which were constantly changing. In other words, it was a process of continual adaptation. In life in general, and in particular, in political life in particular, the Englishman acts like an old-time sailor. He maneuvers in an unstable environment, and he accepts that instability is a fact which he cannot change and which it would be a folly to resent. Incidentally, he is not alone in having learnt this lesson. The Chinese learnt it long ago, and the Italians have learnt it too. One of my friends once objected to something Luzzatti had said, "But, Your Excellency, that is no solution." To which Luzzatti replied, in that Italian accent he so carefully cultivated, and which lent a special savour to all he said, "Mon cher ami, jamais de soluzioni." Shall I confess that in the presence of that continual adaptation, I am overcome by a feeling of exhaustion? I am afraid that we Frenchmen have not abandoned the hope of arriving at definitive solutions, embankments of stone to hold out against eternity, contracts duly drawn up and witnessed to be brandished vainly before the released torrents of history. And we still maintain our faith in man's intelligence. When we say of a man he is intelligent, we think we have said everything. We think we have said everything. Alas, almost all Frenchmen are intelligent. We don't get on any better for that. The Englishman, quite shamelessly, distrusts brilliant intellects. He admires them, of course, but his admiration has that quality of misgiving which one feels for one's pocketbook in the neighbourhood of a clever conjurer. For the Englishman, the intellectual is a sort of mental acrobat, and intellectuality has something pathological in his eyes. In the face of brilliant qualities, he always falls back dourly on his favourite formula. He says, those solid qualities which are 1,000 times preferable, and which at least inspire his confidence. He even goes so far as to prefer his leaders to be a trifle boring, and then he calls them safe. And a self-opinionated man of few words will keep eloquent or over-gifted men from office. My mind immediately went to John Major, who was the Prime Minister when I was growing up, or even Keir Starmer now, I was a bit like that. In this connection, read Lytton Strackley's Eminent Victorians again, and in particular, the portrait, since become classic, of Lord Hartington, Duke of Devonshire, whom Queen Victoria proposed to appoint as Prime Minister instead of Gladstone. And remember that but for two world wars, men like Lloyd George and Winston Churchill would in all probability have never been Prime Ministers. Some years back, I was invited to give a lecture at Eton. And when I asked my hosts whether they could give me any advice as to how I should address the boys, the reply was, "Don't be brilliant." Comment is superfluous. Such are our conclusions, and they are difficult to swallow for Frenchmen, disciples of Descartes, who still believe in the virtue of reason. The Englishman, on the other hand, gladly proclaims the inadequacy of reason, and he does it with a sort of satisfied irony, which, I must confess, annoys me a little. I should feel inclined to call it sadistic if there was anything whatsoever unwholesome or pernicious in his makeup. But perhaps, after all, it is not intelligence which he rejects, not reason, but our particular form of intelligence and reason. No one has put this point of view better than Sir Austen Chamberlain, a man who embodied the best qualities of his country. Speaking in the House of Commons on the 24th of March, 1925, he declared, "I profoundly distrust logic when applied to politics, and all English history justifies me. Why is it that, as contrasted with other nations, ours has been a peaceful and not a violent development? Why is it that, great as have been the changes that have taken place in this country, we have had none of those sudden revolutions and reactions for the last 300 years that have so frequently affected more logically minded nations than ourselves? Is it because instinct and experience alike teach us that human nature is not logical, and it is unwise to treat political institutions as instruments of logic? And that it is in wisely refraining from pressing conclusions to their logical end that the path of peaceful development and true reform is really found." This deliberate absence of method is itself a method. "We'll muddle through somehow," says the Englishman with complacency. And he doesn't just mean in the least what the Frenchman means when he says, "Jimmy de brûlerie." He does not mean that he will extricate himself from a difficult situation by his own ingenuity, which is what the Frenchman means. No, he means that he will flounder around, trusting that he will emerge somehow or other. He doesn't know how. Constant success in the end over a period of several centuries has brought him to believe that he succeeds by his defect, every bit as by his qualities, and this accounts for the complacency with which he refuses to better his ways. The system worked well so long as the country was rich and could afford a good many faults, but now that the margin has become so very much narrower, wouldn't it perhaps be better to give reason a chance? What lessons could be drawn from this attitude in our relations with our English friends, if only we realise that they all think like Sir Austen Chamberlain? When we try to reason with them and to convince them with arguments which seem irrefutable to us, we get the impression that we are talking into empty space, and yet at the same time that we are up against a brick wall. The reason is that they take up their position in discussion on a different ground, or rather on another plane. No argument can shift them. A highly placed Englishman, who has often negotiated on behalf of his government with Frenchman at international conferences, explained his system of defence against them. Invariably, the moment arrives, and often, very often it arrives quickly, when the French representative says to me, "But at least, sir, you'll admit that 2 and 2 make 4? To which I immediately reply, "No." And then the really practical talk begins. Thus, when we negotiate with the English, we should never bargain. They only regard us as hagglers, and themselves lose all standards of judgment with regard to their opposite numbers. The right attitude to adopt is to state our position and stand by it. It will not even be necessary to explain why. Such firmness will arouse their respect, and we shall get more that way than by the most cogent arguments. And when all said and done, I cannot help admiring that rock-like attitude which refuses to budge. The Englishman says he is stupid. How convenient it would be, and I say it with the basest envy, to throw off all the trammels of logic and to manoeuvre light-heartedly, even irresponsibly, in the maze of contradictions. Lord Curzon, a former Viceroy of India, once used the proud formula, "Government goes by personality," and in fact it is thanks to force of character that English tenacity so often has the last word. With this we find ourselves back to the essential thing, that is, moral strength. Here the Englishman reveals himself unquestionably influenced by his Protestant background, that is to say, from the moral point of view. I would not say much from the intellectual point of view. He is an individual. For him, religion and conduct are personal affairs, not necessarily requiring any benefit of clergy in the Roman Catholic sense of the term. He considers himself personally responsible for his actions and for his own behaviour. He feels no need for absolution because it is within himself, with his own conscience, and he must settle his own affairs. This silent sense of duty is one of the most outstanding features of the English character. An Englishman who does his work well asks neither for praise nor encouragement from his superiors. He might even feel inclined to consider such intervention in a sphere which concerns no one but himself as an indiscretion, even if it were a question of praise. It was my duty to do it, and I have done it. That is all. It is a matter of my honour, and with any compliments which you may address to me, will add nothing to my satisfaction at having merely done something to it. Having merely done something it was my duty to do. There is no vanity here. It is a quite specific national form of honour. We must add that this conscience in work is made easy for the Englishman by the fact that he obeys readily and willingly, and that he likes to feel himself part and parcel of a discipline in which his own action is already laid down for him. This is not servility, and there is not the slightest feeling of subjection, but a pride in doing a recognised duty which involves no sacrifice of dignity whatsoever. Discipline in liberty, that is, beyond question, one of the finest English achievements. The inspiration behind it is in this case Protestant. Nevertheless, England has not turned her back altogether on Catholicism. Although she has broken with Rome, she claims in the wider sense to have remained Catholic. By temperament and tradition, the Anglican, though not the nonconformist, loves ritual, and in consequence he feels a very real attraction for Catholic ceremonies. That is the secret of Catholicizing tendencies of the High Church. Does this mean that, having come to the end of its logic, it will return to the papal fold? No, because the Pope is regarded in England as a foreign sovereign, and worse than that, as an Italian sovereign. Truly insular, the Englishman likes to think himself Catholic in the universal sense of the term, but he is not prepared to accept the jurisdiction, even in spiritual matters, of an authority which is not national. With this, we have come back again to that insularity which so profoundly reflects the claim of every Englishman for independence both at home and abroad. The Englishman is a true liberal. He does not impose his ways on others, but he wants to be left in peace to himself. His private life must be respected, and no one has any right to interfere. This liberalism, moreover, is curiously tinged with indifference, even with egotism. But that, after all, is perhaps the best guarantee of its maintenance. He respects your liberty, but that is also perhaps because he is so very little interested in you. Let everyone lead his own life. There is something not altogether civilized about it, and one can say of these people that, charitable as they are, capable as they are of apostleship, they are less civilized than we are. The community of mankind, the solidarity of other men, means much less to them. Some people believe that they are contemptuous of others. I am not so sure of that, but nevertheless, I feel a trace of discomfort when I draw the line between this respect for the liberty of others, which is their own liberty, and the absence of all interest, verging on disdain, in what other people think or do in life. The legendary Englishman who says, "Wogs begin at Calais," may... The legendary Englishman who says wogs begin at Calais may think he is being merely funny, but I am sorry. It did make me laugh, to be fair. But I am not so sure there isn't something more in that joke. The Englishman is not personally proud, but he is nationally proud, and he certainly thinks himself of another strain than the natives who constitute the rest of mankind. And if anyone presumes to say that the English are God's own people, he will not readily contradict. From this desire to remain distinct arises an inexpressible distrust of everything which is not English. And it is a distrust which applies to Latins in particular amongst all foreigners. The Englishman admires the Frenchman for his intelligence and for his brilliant sense of the artistic and for his capacity for thought. But morally, he rarely, if ever, has any confidence in him. We find, this is your cheese-eating surrender monkeys talk, right? We even find, particularly amongst the most insular of Englishmen, amongst those, and after all, they are the great majority, who have never left the shores of England, an unwillingness when it is a question of collaborating with us. And if they finally do decide to collaborate, their agreement has a certain air of complicity. I mean, he's basically saying that Brexit was absolutely inevitable here. I'm not sure I entirely disagree with him either. A story, apocryphal perhaps, once told me it is not entirely without a point. At a criminal trial, a young Londoner was called to give evidence of the character of the accused. "Has anything ever come to your knowledge to suggest that the accused is anything but a respectable person?" she was asked. "No," she replied. And then, after a moment's hesitation, she added, "though I do believe he was brought up in Paris." "Though I do believe he was brought up in Paris." For one witness, at least, that was obviously not a recommendation. The Englishman, so individual in matters of moral responsibility, is nevertheless not an individual in all aspects of individuality. And in any case, he is not a real individual in a Latin sense, which involves the independence of critical spirit and the insistence that each man should form his own opinion by means of his reasoning faculties. There is no doubt, of course, that the Englishman is just as capable as the Frenchman of freely and reasonably forming his own opinions on things. But in practice, he willingly accepts the opinions of his leaders, that his leaders place before him. Once the leader of the party has spoken in England, the mass of its members experience no difficulty whatsoever in accepting his views. And that is probably the secret of that admirable discipline, which is the strength of the British parliamentary regime. It is also one of the sources of that civic sense and that devotion to which public affairs, by virtue of which everyone, while still maintaining his own reserve, feels it his duty to take his place in the community and play his part in social life. This fact explains why the Englishman, so efficient when he is part of a smooth-running organization, is so at a loss when he is expected to extricate himself from a difficult situation on his own. Say de roulier, to use an expression which is rather too popular in France, to shift for himself. In times of crisis, the Latin, the Mediterranean, finds himself possessed of a highly valuable superiority. Each man reaches his goal in his own way and with the methods best suited to himself. Two conceptions of social life, two ways of looking at the problems of labor, responsibility, and efficiency, face each other. You can get the most out of an Englishman by appealing to his sense of duty. Where a Latin is concerned, you must appeal to his self-respect. It has been said that the Nordic is the superior being. I do not believe it to be the case in all cases. I do not believe that it is so in all cases. The English contribution to our Western civilization is outstanding. It is at least as great as our own, but it is so different that at first sight one is astonished that we should have been classed as being belonging to the same big European family. Of all the civilized people, the English are, both by their responsiveness and their methods, the closest to nature. In his insistent desire to define, analyze, and classify nature, the Frenchman often runs the danger of distorting her features, of attributing a logical raison d'etre to her, which he does not in fact possess. The American, whilst claiming to speed up her rhythm artificially, fails to recognize certain deep-seated laws of natural development, and it is perhaps as a result of this oversight that his civilization will ultimately perish. John Bull has the feeling for nature and an instinctive knowledge of her laws. He developed, worked, acts, and thinks in sympathy with her as though he were part of her, and he is not ignorant of the fact that the law of life embraces imperfections. His attitude is one of adaptation and a certain humility. And this results in an approach to problems which is specifically English. Nature non nisi parento imperator, wrote Bacon. One can master nature only by obeying her laws. Bacon was an Englishman, his fellow countrymen, as much and naturally his disciples as we are disciples of Descartes, are in fact never arrogant towards nature or things. I will not say that they are deferential either. Perhaps it would be better to simply say that they are natural. This attitude comes all the more easily to them because they must be classed among the ingenious rather than amongst the perfidious. If there is such a thing as perfidious Albion, it is, as we shall see later, only in certain very definite circumstances and to some extent when they are defending their lives, which does not mean that there is no such thing. And here I find myself again at the question of age. Just a little while ago, I find myself again at the question of insularity. From certain aspects, the Englishman stays 15 years old all his life. He is young, as young animals are young, and in his everyday affairs, he displays in consequence a quite a charming naivety, a truly intimidable simplicity. And by contrast, our cold glance, which sees clearly and is, above all, well content to see clearly, begins to seem cynical. It is in his love of animals that this perpetual adolescent most perfectly expresses and even surpasses himself. I really believe he prefers them to his fellow human beings. A few years ago, I read in the columns of the Times, if you please, the following letter addressed to the editor. Sir, I noted two butterflies in my garden yesterday. This is 2 weeks earlier than usual at this time of year. The great organ of the city, as it is called, considered these few lines about the early butterflies worthy of space. I mentioned this letter in my lecture I delivered on the English, and one of the listeners drew my attention to another letter sent to the editor of the Times by a well-known personality in Oxford. Sir, as this is Safety First Week here, here is an incident which I think may be of interest to your readers. When I was driving back to Oxford this afternoon, I saw a dog crossing the road in front of my car. I slowed down and sounded my horn. The dog stopped, wagged its tail, and went back. As I passed him, he stood on the pavement and watched me, expressing his thanks by a friendly wagging of his tail. And the white book published by the Foreign Office after the rapture with Hitler contains an analogous passage, which is particularly significant because it appears in an official document. The British ambassador in Berlin advises his minister that he repatriated under satisfactory conditions the personnel of his embassy, consisting of 13 men, 5 women, and 2 dogs. Was that supposed to be humorous? Were the precise details of the evacuation of such a nature as to interest the foreign secretary? I don't know, but at least it is quite certain that a people who can talk in this fashion about the humbler brethren of the animal world cannot be an evil people. This decency, this simplicity, this initial confidence represent the basis for those solutions which make up English life. They explain very well, indeed, that there is original and unique, what there is original and unique in English science and literature. I do not believe there are any better observers of nature than the English. They know how to observe before jumping to conclusions, and without finding themselves necessarily obliged to draw conclusions at all. They are wise, and better still, they love what they observe more than they love themselves, and in such a fashion that self-effacement is not difficult for them. One gets the impression that they worship not only the animals they watch with such passionate attention, but also the trees and the stones, all that mineral kingdom we are accustomed to class as inanimate, though in the eyes of these poets, it is most assuredly not inanimate. Their literature, particularly when it deals with psychology, bears an analogous stamp. They observe men with patience, in great detail and in good faith, as though they were studying natural history, and not in the manner of the French, with the arrière-pensée of turning a novel into a classic tragedy. In this way, they have assembled an untold wealth of evidence which represents the archives of civilization. An author may occasionally permit himself to intervene with humour, or perhaps even as a polemicist, but he almost always resists the temptation to improve what nature created before him. It is above all in business and in politics the contribution of England is inseparable from the very development of our civilization. The English did not invent the credit system, but they have practiced it better than any other people. In their conception, it is a reflection of the confidence an honest man deserves, and his word is worth all the signatures imaginable. This mutual confidence, which exists between people living together on the same island, is certainly the social trait the stranger finds most striking. In England, unlike other countries, it is distrust which is exceptional, and the whole balance of relationships between individuals and groups is based on the assurance that there will be no deception. The conception of the gentleman is based on the same principle. It is the translation to the social and fashionable world of honnêt homme. But there is a nuance. There is less accent on good nature than on good manners, and that, at the same time, there is a moral obligation on the upper class. In this country of conformism, a gentleman is one who knows how to behave himself in all circumstances, who dresses properly and at the proper time, and who seeks to remain at this side of perfection, which might cause him to be taken for a professional. Care, never extreme care, says Brummel. But a gentleman is also one who preserves his moral dignity. A gentleman is also one who preserves his moral dignity intact, and one, therefore, on whom the world can rely. I do not think that England has produced a nobler or more essentially national conception than that. Let me confess that the gentleman has sometimes made me very impatient because of his only too obvious limitations, and in particular, because of the excessive readiness with which he accepts them. However, when one has made the acquaintance of so many ill-bred and morally irresponsible fellows throughout the world, and we have all known how frequent the type is, one returns again and again to the gentleman as to an incomparable haven of moral reliability. And in politics, and for the same reason, England has solved problems that have puzzled all other countries. She has taught us and proved her lesson by practical example that liberty and authority are not contradictory terms, that one can obey the laws of the land without sacrificing one's dignity, that liberty does not necessarily mean license, or authority tyranny. As has often been pointed out, we are dealing here with a Calvinist conception of society, and it has very little relation to what we call power in the sense of the Roman Imperium. The government is not a transcendent authority which opposes its will on the community, but merely an expression of the communal interest, a sort of delegation of community power. The community seeks to administer its affairs as simply as would an individual or a group of individuals. Thus, the administration of public affairs does not involve that kind of august or sinister mystery which derives in our country not from the mandate of the governed, but from the raison d'être. This raison d'être exists in England too, but in foreign policy only, where it is a question of preserving the national interests. As remote but authentic disciples of Calvin, the English sincerely believe the moral law should extend even into the domain of politics. However, a man must live, and unfortunately the laws of life do not always run parallel with such an ideal. Luther found a realist solution for that problem, but the English, less courageous, are content with what Casamain has called the doctrine of implicit delegation. A British statesman will seek to observe the moral laws in his political actions, but if he finds it humanly impossible, and if the interests of the nation demand it, then an implicit delegation authorizes him to transgress them. Wordlessly, the cloak of Noah is placed around his shoulders. Yet, yes, it is hypocritical, of course, but do you really prefer the cynicism of Bismarck? The world of the 19th century was made habitable thanks to England. Rejuvenated by the practice of free trade, it was thanks to England that stable and complementary relations were established between the various continents. To go out into the world before 1914 was to enter at once into a sort of international commercial republic which existed under the British aegis and in which British methods prevailed. Strangers benefited just as much as British subjects from the principle of fair play, and all whites enjoyed the benefits of Pax Britannica on the simple condition that they recognised and obeyed the rules. In this way, England taught the world a lesson in liberty, but alas, it was one which the world did not grasp. In this respect, the 20th century lags behind the 19th, and the English, tired of being wise on their own, have themselves returned the same doctrines of protectionism and state control whose abandonment led to their greatness. However, they have remained faithful to the idea of liberty of the individual in society. Well, that may have been true in 1952, I don't know about now. And they are temporarily hostile to persecution and arbitrariness. Even war has not succeeded in turning them away from an age-old tradition, so firmly are they persuaded that liberty is the source of riches and power. Unfortunately, all the deep-seated tendencies of the present century seem to face in a different direction, and yet we feel clearly ourselves, in our heart of hearts, that withdraw ourselves from the English ideal in this respect is to withdraw ourselves from civilization. Today, the English system has been largely abandoned and forced on the defensive, and in defending herself, England has come to adopt measures and even doctrines which contradict her whole liberal tradition. How is England to adapt herself to the completely new conditions of the industrial production and exchange and to the new role of the state in an equalitarian age? And can she, in fact, adapt herself? No. In the 19th century, the Englishman succeeded thanks to outstanding qualities which he alone possessed in that period. But at the same time, we must not overlook the fact that he has also succeeded because he has enjoyed a quasi-monopoly of coal and industry in the age of the steam engine, and because his position was reinforced by the possession of accumulated riches which were enormous for that day. He believed himself to be operating under conditions of free competition, but actually the atmosphere was one of international privilege. His beloved system of muddling through therefore worked. Today, margins have become very much narrower. and such primitive devices are no longer appropriate to the situation. What he's saying is muddling through does not work in the managerial age, is what he's saying. Today, there is open competition, and whoever wants to keep his end up can only hope to do so by superior technique and by harder work. To understand the astonishing success of the English regime in former days, it should be noted that whilst its institutions were authentically democratic, it remained until quite recently aristocratic in practice. The elector was sovereign in his choice, but he usually chose to delegate his power to representatives of the nobility, wealth, and tradition, with the result that English democracy functioned more or less like an aristocracy. The First World War did not greatly change that state of affairs, but the Second World War brought about a real revolution. The people have become equalitarian in outlook, convinced that having contributed to victory, they now had the right to contribute to post-war recovery and to share in all its benefits. The country is no longer governed today by men who were educated in the great public schools and taught to uphold the aristocratic tradition, but by men of the people, leaders of trade unions, former minor officials, and so on. The change is total, and the only question now is whether these new rulers will be assimilated into the ancient elite, educated and absorbed by it, as the rising industrialists of the 19th century were integrated with the landed nobility of the past. The question is topical, but we are not yet in a position to answer it. And we do know that England has always shown itself able, to use a biblical expression, to put new wine into old bottles. All right, extremely interesting analysis from Siegfried. I look forward to the comments on this one. At times, I thought he was a bit harsh from his friend's perspective, but on the whole, I do very much recognize the picture that he's painting, certainly of the country I grew up in, although the extent to which it is still true in 2025, well, that's a question to be asked. All right. Hope you join me again next week when we move on to gym and discipline. That ought to be fun. And yeah, I'm enjoying this series. Promo code Mandy gets you 25% off all courses. And I will see you again next time. If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.